Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you through the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is the second part of episode 33, where we are discussing Roethlisberger's The Foreman, Master and Victim of Double Talk. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
So in the first part of the podcast, we discussed a lot of the problems, circumstances, cases, experiences, and Roethlisberger saved for the end, which makes sense, a discussion of solutions to the problem, in particularly the administrative process or the administrative person. And we're going to spend some time now looking at that part of his paper.
Yeah, so he actually refers to the administrative function in the role of the administrator, right, to have a focus on the feelings and relationships that have to be part of what the foreman pays attention to. And I actually found this part of the article very satisfying because after going through all those problems, it was a bit gloomy. And so things pick up when he starts talking about the administrator. He also gives a hint to, he's generalizing a lot about from those other, in those other parts of the article, the earlier part. And now he's talking more about what he thinks can happen. And he refers to, I thought this was really interesting. He said, you know, not only do you have men of goodwill, but he says, you see people in organizations who are extraordinarily good at eliciting cooperation and cooperative effort with people. And I just thought it was interesting. He refers to this as an administrative function. I guess you got to call it something. I mean, it's something that sometimes engineers refer to as touchy-feely, you know, and they say that in a dismissive way. I thought it was really interesting because I've seen this too. He says sometimes these people either get criticized or people think that they lack ambition because they pay attention to group solidarity and they think social relations and getting along are important. And in fact, I was in a management training class one time when we were talking about change, and I think we took a show of hands, and they said, you know, when you're implementing a change, how many of you think it's, you know, what you need to focus on is the details of how the change goes about happening, or you want to implement the change so you get it right? So some large number of people, because this was an engineering production organization I was in, large number of people in the class raised their hand. And then they said, well, how many people think the people are where you got to focus? And maybe only one or two hands go up. And I must admit, mine was not one of them. And I felt bad, but I just thought, what's that guy know that I don't know? And he happened to be a friend of mine, and we've been friends ever since. And so I did ask him about that. And there was some good class discussion about that, about why that, you know, why, where's that focus? And why is it different? And Roethlisberger, you know, says, well, these guys look like they're accomplishing their mission, that these people who are the administrators, through a leisurely social interaction, which I thought was kind of funny, as opposed to vigorous formal action. But to them, they want to get the human relationships right. That's more important than getting the logics straight. And I thought that was important.
Well, in a way, I think nowadays we have moved and it would be getting, you know, the logics and the works needs to be done through managing the relationships, not only the tasks.
And I thought this section was important. I was somewhat disappointed because he called it an administrative process, but at the same time, I thought that was important. If he'd really been trying to be flashy, he would have called it a leadership process.
Oh, way to go.
but he really focused on by calling it administrative, he allows the focus to be more direct, I think, rather than what a lot of other people have called leadership. Now, the other interesting part I thought was that some of the characteristics line up with Collins's level 5 leadership.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm.
And so I saw this as a precursor to that work.
Interesting. I think I have a theory why he calls it the administrative. Because if you think about in historic terms, so basically he's talking about the foreman, which was this craft-based-like role. And then came Taylorism, and things were, you know, formalized, and this person was stripped away of the control of the work in itself, and he has only to follow the procedures and make sure that the workers follow it. But he's still in the foreman title. There is this old school idea of, you know, being the one that is among the workers. Administrative has this idea of a professional manager. So I think that's what he's trying to say. You know? So in a new system, the old school foreman cannot exist anymore because everything has changed around him or her. So what is needed is a different kind of function, and one that's going to pay attention on a number of things that is going to make possible this tayloristic, machine-like, compartmentalized kind of system works, which is a professional manager.
Oh, I agree. In fact, I think that's very insightful, Pedro, because at the end of that section, before he gets into the part about what's the solution, I think he hints at what you just said. I just didn't see it as well until you said it, where he says that these the theories of administration, that's what he called it, that are frequently expressed by leaders, experts, and teachers, right? So he's got the leader word in there, bear little resemblance to the functions these men actually perform and give justification to their actions, and then makes the people who are doing these functions feel inferior as a result, right? Because it doesn't come up very often. And so I think that's a great point, that because of the nature of how he's seen work change over the 25 years he often brings up, that he's got to add something new, because it's that probably never going to go back to the way the foreman used to be. So you need to think about it differently. That's I think what's really interesting about the way you brought that up. All right. And then in the next section, he talks about the solution,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, of course, as a guy who as a guy who likes to focus on the social relations aspect, I'm a big Roethlisberger fan here. This idea that you have to have an inexorable working out of the social forces
mm-hmm.
that modern technology and also the way we break down the work. So it's not just the technology. It's more like the technology of how we organize work too. And that you have to work out these social forces that we have not learned how to recognize or really how to control. That's not exactly a quote, but that's sort of my way. And then we talk about it's a result, and this goes back to what Joe and I were saying in the last episode, was about it comes from our ignorance and our failure to pay explicit attention to the social organization of teamwork, because we tend to pay much more attention, I'm not sure why, to the logical organization of the work.
What I think that he's hitting that's exactly, you know, this idea of a manager needs not only to understand the task in itself, but has to understand the system of the tasks and the relations to accomplish that task.
Yes.
And also,
yes.
And I really like what he's get at, especially towards the end, in which he has a list of almost suggestions, which we read very contemporary. You know, things as how much the management needs to listen, the workers needs to put in place a more participative system, or I really like the one he hints at the fact that you have to understand the organization, which stands for, you know, the informal process, the informal organization, you know, the system of interdependence of the tasks, not only the single thing in itself to be done.
Right. Well, I think that's so important. It's a great point you made. Let's go through them one by one. So he does that in the section called A New Concept of Administration, where he's trying to describe what the future organization needs to be based on his analysis of these role conflicts and ambiguities that foremen and middle managers, I'll read a little into that, have, and the nature of the formal logical structure of work and then the social relations.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one he brings up is you have to have like you said, Pedro, a better understanding of the organization, not just its structure, mm-hmm. right? This is what I was reacting to when Joe was asking about the exhibit of the diagram of the organization, but also the dynamic interrelations. Because he says earlier in the book, that's how work gets done,
is
these interrelations people have.
If you want, I think that it was the moment that I said, oh, if we have never championed that or raised that flag, people like me, you, and you know, Joe, or anyone that does kind of organizational behavior related things wouldn't have a job. Because that's the point,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because if you think it's not only about...
Well, having a job is good. That's a good thing to bring up.
No, because if you think about it, it's the idea that, you know, to be a manager, to be an administrator, doesn't mean just to control the work in itself of one person, but understanding the work system in which you are embedded, which is organization yes. management yes. theory in a way.
That's a great observation. So I'm going to give you an example that I know will resonate with Joe because he and I were at the same organization. Mm-hmm. And so I had gone to several meetings where I didn't actually decide who was going to be at the meeting, but we were planning work and what was going to happen. And it didn't happen, you know, after we had these meetings. And I finally went to ask somebody, what am I doing wrong? And he said, well, you're not talking to the people who do the work. And they're not, you know, they're not present at the meetings. So I found out that this was a social aspect of the work, that the nature of the way the work was done in the, what are called the shops or the trade specializations, where you would have people that would not necessarily be the shop leader, but they would be people that the people in the shop looked up to. So they might be foremen, they might be somebody higher than a foreman, but not always. And it varied by shop mm-hmm. who these people were. What I found out was you had to go talk to them.
Yeah.
And they sometimes knew enough about the work that they could plan it, they could help you plan it, or they would have to go talk to a couple of their peers, and they knew who to speak to, right? Because they knew who, what we would call in the United States, the go-to people were, might be male or female. And then they would give you this insight and say, well, you have to have so-and-so at the meeting, or we have to talk to this person, or we have to find out what this group needs. And they would help you do that. And from my perspective as a senior leader in this organization, I was, you know, the senior executive staff. It was just pragmatic. You know, I didn't, my ego wasn't involved in this. I just want to get the work done. And I didn't want to come to tears all the time being unsuccessful because workers knew the work better than I did. So that didn't bother me at all. And then once I figured out, I felt like somebody had given me the combination to a safe, you know, for unlocking getting work done. So I was very happy with that. It did not bother my ego at all, although I can see there are some people that would get frustrated. Like, well, I told them to do it and they didn't do it. And I saw people like that, but I wasn't one of them.
So the skill of asking the open-ended question, who needs to be at the meeting, and allowing the organization's experts, so to speak, to get the right people there, produces phenomenal results in my experience. And that's replicated both where we were, and it has been replicated time after time in other organizations. So that's a very difficult question for some people to answer. And there may be internal rules that keep them from being effective, right?
Yeah. Right?
So one organization I've consulted to, and this wasn't the only one, but I was pretty shocked, meeting with managing directors, and VPs, one or two SVPs, and the meeting was essentially worthless because their internal rule does not allow the designated alternate to commit their component to the decision.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And since it's an organization that has extensive travel, they only infrequently have all the principals present.
I was just going to say, if alternates can't commit, first of all, why have them? And second of all, there's no point in having the meeting then.
Right. So, yeah, me as an outsider listening to the alternates, they knew exactly what to do, made extremely valuable contributions, and the risk of them having made the wrong choice was very low in my perspective. So that's, that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Is understanding the dynamic interrelations. Mm-hmm. And the organization I was consulting to did not understand how they had created this huge obstacle with their well-meaning rule.
I've been in organizations where you'd have a project team or an ad hoc team that get created. And one of the first ground rules you'd have to create was, if you're coming to this meeting in the place of so-and-so, you must be able to make a decision.
Correct.
And if you can't do that, then we can't have the meetings. Right? You got to make that a very early ground rule. And what I think is interesting about the example Joe gives is that this is like a cultural feature of the organization, that's not something that's not a requirement. Mm. That would be very hard to get stuff done.
Can I just say one thing to complicate this whole idea? You know, because I think we are hitting at the, I would say, number three of the suggestions of Ralph Lisberger, in which,
yes.
you know, this idea of, you know, communication yeah. being he explicitly talks about listening as an important skill for the administrator. But I think that the problem is, for instance, I study complex high-tech corporations. And one of the problems in, for instance, product development and the whole issue of who are the experts you have to invite to the meeting and who are the functional leaders you have to invite is sometimes you just don't know what the interdependencies are. You don't know who should be involved in a design change because there's so many ripple effects that you maybe have to invite someone that's responsible for, I don't know, writing the technical manuals for that thing. You never thought about that, you know? So what kind of mechanisms do you have in place to make sure that, you know, you have a system awareness?
Well, my own perspective, and I know Joe will have some too, is that happens and you take it as a sign of an opportunity to learn, because many times you don't know all those things that go into the final solution when you're first starting to propose this engineering change or this product development or something. And I think what you have to demonstrate is flexibility to say, okay, who's not, first of all, when you get in the room, you say, who's not here that should be here? And then sometimes it just takes experience. My cousin is a technical writer, and she would say sometimes she'd be given some, you know, technical process to document, and she'd say, you can't execute that. And the people would get frustrated. She'd say, look, you can't just hand me this bunch of directions and say, go write a manual. you need to let me participate. So I thought that was a great example, Pedro, about saying you had to bring those people on. So part of it, unfortunately, or fortunately, depends on how you look at it, it comes from experience. You have to say, oh, we've messed this up before and we need to bring this new person in. And then you have to have people on the team that say, yep, we can be flexible and, you know, and listen to what this person says, because it doesn't do you any good to bring the technical writer in if you're going to ignore everything that they say.
Yeah.
So I also think there's some element of bootstrapping where, you know, you gradually expand the circle of the team that's working on the problem. And, you know, various strategies I've seen when the specific person's not there is, can you get somebody who's close? Or can you make progress in this meeting and bring them in on a later meeting?
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
And then the other is, especially if there's a lot of co-location, is can you get the person that you need to the meeting quick enough that it's worth everyone sitting there 5 minutes while they walk down?
Yeah, and we've done that. I've done that before where the person, they're a couple rooms away, so they're pretty easy to get. Or even sometimes, like Joe was saying, it's so important for making the plan that, yeah, you could work on some piece of it, but then you get that person on the phone and you say, hey, come down here, we need you. And they can join you in progress. So, yeah, I think that bootstrapping is a great way to describe that.
So a lot of times I've actually had an executive assistant with me sitting next to me. Her role was to go find those people as we were going through the discovery.
Yeah.
Now, I was just going to say that we are now hitting at the fourth one, which I think it is this idea of participation.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, he specifically says that, you know, things, you know, he's talking about change in general, but, you know, when you set up the specific processes and you select a procedure, people, of course, are going to be resistant if they don't participate, which is something we take for granted today, you know, but it still is a tough lesson to learn for many people.
That's a great point. And I think, you know, one of the things that Joe and I have seen many times when you're implementing a change is you've got to give people a stake in the outcome. Or ownership of the problem, right? So people just don't get very motivated. And many times you don't have to say, hey, you can veto everything we're doing, but you gotta have them participate. And I remember it in my early days of learning that in the Navy, you know, you get these people come up with just these crazy ideas, right, that you couldn't implement. And so I had to take some time to explain to people, look, just because I don't do exactly what you said, because I'm not sure how to do it, or I'm having some troubles with feasibility, doesn't mean I'm not listening to you. And so keep making the suggestions, but realize that we won't necessarily be able to use all of them. And I think that goes back to the social relations aspect, right? You have to make it clear to people, hey, your input's valuable, even if I don't use every single thing you do or everything you include. So participation, and I think you have to send that signal explicitly. You know, Roethlisberger talks in the item 4 you're talking about is this getting these new insights to human motivations. So, I mean, one of these insights I think that I personally came to was I want you to provide input, but it doesn't mean I will always use it. And then actually as a corollary, I used to tell people, you may give me input that I don't use, but because I don't understand it. So you can't assume just because you say something that we should do something that I get it. And I used to encourage people, if it wasn't going to be too disruptive, I would say, hey, if I don't get it the first time, you can say it a couple more times to me, but I would say, don't say it the exact same way, because I can't always, you know, hear it differently. But if you think I'm really not getting it, try a few more times. And I would give them an example where I didn't get till the third time the person gave me the input, and I realized I was completely misunderstanding what they were suggesting and what was the nature of the problem. And then I thought, oh, okay, now I know what you're talking about. And I said, I'm sorry I missed it, but I want to make sure he felt that it mattered to me, that he could bring it up again. So that's what I think. That's one of the things I think Roethlisberger is talking about when he talks about motivations.
I just want to plug one thing, because you talk about participation, but you also said for a second something related to ownership. And there is a recent paper it was just published at ISQ, you know, the flagship journal of our discipline, by Melissa Valentine, in which, the paper is entitled Renegotiation Spheres of Obligation, the Role of Hierarchy in Organizational Learning. And she was looking at change in hospitals, and she followed two process improvement projects. And she realized that the ones in which both had a participation, the process improvement consultants were bringing the functional managers, but in one, they were just there and, discussing. And in the other, they were asking the managers and everyone that was, going to be affected by the change to take ownership over the issues, meaning that they were supposed to make the decisions in their own situation to consider what kind of resources were going to be needed, what kind of micro changes the major change would lead to, said they felt they owned the thing. They were, in a way liable and responsible and wanted to contribute. That made the difference because, the ones in which this happened, the change was successful, whereas in the other, it was not so much.
That's why I follow an action research approach in consulting rather than just handing it over.
Yeah. Mm, yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So you've helped lead us through, Pedro. I don't know if you guys noticed, but I thought that Roethlisberger was purposeful in 1-4, because what he laid out in 1 is theory.
Yep.
In 2, he laid out language.
Yeah, that was great. That's the one we skipped, was this need for a new language.
And then he came to comms and tools. So yep. It wasn't until 4 that he got to tools, and now we can go back to language.
I think that's a great insight, is that, and I think that sequence matters, right? Because if you just jump into tools without having this the theory and the communications language aspect of it, you're going too far ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one thing I was thinking about when Pedro was talking about that article, one of the things that comes to mind for me is the classic article written by Piderit in 2000. The title is Rethinking Resistance and Recognizing Ambivalence. And there's a lot more text after the colon, but that's good enough if anybody wants to search for it, and it's available on the web. And Piderit's argument, based on studying some organizations and change, is it's a source of strength to go to your workers to find out what they're ambivalent about and why. And it'll make it'll actually help you inform your change better. And I found this many times in my personal life and career, professional career, was that instead of saying, well, Joe isn't just, he's just not listening, he's being hard-headed. It might be true, but if I take a different approach, what does Joe see that I don't? What am I missing? And try to find out from him by asking, as opposed to telling, asking Joe, well, why won't you do what I want? What are you seeing? I found many times you got great insight, because a lot of times people won't tell you, it goes back to that language and the theory and the tools. People won't tell you, not because they're trying to be resistant, they don't think you care. You haven't sent a strong signal that it really matters to you.
So for me, who brought up the concept of Leon Trankel's dissonance, where different disciplines develop concepts and use different words for what is fundamentally the same underlying concept. And therefore, when people try to talk across the disciplinary barriers, it's as if they're talking a different language, which they are.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I think his point, though, that you have to come up with a common language is important. Otherwise, you've invoked a barrier that's existed since time immemorial.
if I can spin this, you know, I know he's talking about language, but I didn't only see language as, you know, as a semantic thing, but I also saw as common ground kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, because in a time like this, the workers were supposed to, you know, do the work, not think, so they would never know what the strategy of the company was, what the goals were, how the company was performing. And it's something that nowadays we know it's important, you know, the awareness that the workers have of the overall situation. So basically, I think languaging means in a way that, you know, they all are on the same page and they understand what is the organization, how well the organization is doing, what is supposed to be done, what are the goals, what, you know, the metrics, and so on and so forth.
Right. I think that's a great observation. It's not purely semantics. So if you look at comms, it's like, I just need to get the idea across better. You're missing the point. It's more of a creating a common understanding, like Joe was talking about, not only because you got to get the vocabulary right and make sure you're saying the concepts are understandable, but because you create that environment where they understand how their work fits in. That's one of the things Deming said was a real function of leaders, is to help people understand where they fit in the system. And so I think that's what you were getting at, Peter, which I think is really good. And to go back to the six-item list that Roethlisberger had, is this kind of new view of administration, concept of administration. So Joe was talking about this tools, right? Four and five are the tools, and they're kind of different ways to look at different kinds of tools. But in five, you know, they're talking about this understanding of the social aspects of the way people work in the organization and people's need for security and feeling like they matter and understand the importance of the work, which I think is what Pedro was talking about. And then he finishes up with, I think, which is a nice way to encapsulate all of this. In item six, he talks about the new administrator has to distinguish, but also, I think, bridge, he doesn't say that in the first sense, but manage the world of feelings and the world of facts and logic, and acknowledge or recognize that they both exist and are important. And he's got a great line in there. He says, only by paying as much attention, this is what Joe and I were talking about, only by paying as much attention to informal organization as to formal organization will he or she become aware of what can and cannot be accomplished by policy formulation at this concrete level of behavior, right? So you really have to recognize the spirit of what's going on, which I think is a very nice way to round out that list.
Yeah. Can I just add, like, the next sentence, I think it's also very rich because you say, he or she will have to learn new techniques of control. And that's so contemporary, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I would argue in some ways it's not really control. And he's writing back in 1945, so that's the terminology they used.
Yes, yes.
But I think it's not even control anymore. It's more like guidance and coaching. That's what we think the new model, or at least what a lot of the current scholarship on the new model of leadership is about.
So, yes, exactly.
So if you notice, he quotes around control all four times he used it in paragraph.
Ah, that's true. Good point. That's a good point.
I believe he's trying to get at, even though he didn't describe it, what we would consider the more modern view of control, not the hierarchical top-down command and control environment, but more where control establishes constraints which help guide the individuals in the organization, which is a much more cybernetics view of control.
So that brings us to the end of the text of the article. And what I thought would be useful at this point is to just review, as a way of tying it together, some of the themes that I saw in the article, and then give you guys a chance to react. I won't read them all at once. I'll read them one at a time. And then if I, when we get to the end of, you know, if you think I messed it up, great. Help me get the right way to look at that. And then if you want to add other themes that you think are different or slightly differently stated, that would be also helpful. So the first thing that just jumped out at me, and you, I guess it could come in any order, but was this idea of role conflict and ambiguity, right? This idea about the foreman being in the middle, and that's the essence of where the title comes from, this master of the victim of double talk. And that is that one of the things I was thinking about there is Katz and Kahn and their classic work, The Social Psychology of Organizations, in Chapter 7, which is about the taking of organizational roles. They talk about, or wrote about, that there's little research on this this role conflict. You know, some, but not as much as they say it should happen. But they say, but they suggest that the impact of this role conflict and ambiguity is probably stress. And they actually do refer to some studies where they show it's many other professions besides production industrial kind of work.
What I think that, you know, ties in, well, not necessarily maybe with this example, but the overall, you know, problem of being in the middle, you know, is the research that is done on boundary spanners that suggests that people across departments, specializations, even organizations struggle because, of course, you are the same trying to... Well, it's not easy being a connector. It's not in trying to belong to two different social worlds, you know?
Yeah. Well, in fact, and Fayol talks about that in his book, The Work That We Analyze, these ideas that you have people, I think he called them ladders, where they go across the sort of stovepipes or parts of the organization. And so I think boundary spanners is a good way to capture that, Pedro. So the next thing I was thinking about was this kind of conflict with a Taylorism and top-down approach versus the social aspect. And I wondered, and maybe this isn't a theme, it's just more something I was thinking about, is that, and I did address it in the last episode where I talked about this cultural influence. Because if you look at some of the strife that goes on in some U.S. and British workplaces versus the approach the Germans and the Japanese take to building trust and the role of unions and those kinds of things, it's quite a bit different, actually. And in fact, I was reading, I think it was in the article that, it wasn't in the book that Maitland wrote. So Maitland wrote a book in 2017. It was called The Causes of Industrial Disorder in Comparison of a British and German Factory. And he attributes these differences in the relations to the breakdown of governance in the British factories, that basically because the foreman's role got de-skilled, then everything went to these formalized processes and the foreman didn't have as much influence. And then basically things got very acrimonious. And so he's looking at two factories doing very similar work and the differences in the way the British foreman and the German foreman took to this. So I think there's something to that, because I was another article that's similar was written by Lorenz in 1992. And this gets to the reason why I kept using the word trust all the time. The title of the article is Trust and the Flexible Firm, International Comparisons. And it was published in Industrial Relations. And they were looking at, again, German and Japanese companies. And they had an interview with a Japanese manager. And he said, I usually make all my own decisions or most of my own decisions, but I will talk to the workers first and try to get their perspective. And sometimes I'm trying to convince them, but many times I'm also learning from them and I make a better decision as a result of talking to them. So that reflects a whole different level of trust in your workers and belief in their contribution to the output than a strict Tayloristic approach saying, you know, it's top down, I give the rules, you take the orders, you know, that kind of stuff.
No, I totally agree. You know, and I mean, again, you know, we can really see with these examples and the discussion we had, how much the foreman struggles is actually a systemic issue, you know, and I think, you know, the author tries to say that, you know, it's a private thing, but it's because it's embedded in a whole system in which it's supposed to wipe out as things of its social dynamics and just, you know, pretend that people can work one-to-one, so the foreman can work individually with each worker and control their work and go on like that, but actually that creates a lot of problems, so...
Right. Well, and there's a great line in the Lorenz article that's, I think, very similar to what Roethlisberger is talking about. That's why I brought it up. They said Japanese management, you know, they consult their workforce in part because they believe it to be in their best interest. Yep. Okay. But also because they believe it to be the right thing to do. And Lorenz goes on to say normative and rational motivations combine and reinforce each other, which I think is what you were talking about, Pedro. And then another theme I saw was that the worker attitudes towards innovation and change, you know, vary systemically, and has to do with some a bit of compensation, but also about this employment structure, right? And that's what Roethlisberger is talking about. Look, if you just set up this rigid structure, and then the foreman's just this transmitter of change, it's not so easy to get people to take ownership or accept the change because they've had no say in it.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because, you know, as a person interested in bureaucracy, I think many times people blame bureaucracy for the resistance to change when it's it's not the existence of formalization itself that is the problem, but it's the fact that people have no autonomy in the way things are going to change and, you know, what is supposed to happen and how much clear they have what they have to do. You know, Toyota is a great example on things that are very formalized, but they are very easy to change in a way because, you know, they have ways to bring those that are, you know, going to be involved in the change. So this way it flows more easily.
Well, that's a great observation. And I think that Joe and I were talking about that when we worked in shipyards, they are very bureaucratic. And, you know, when I say that, I mean, from an organizational point of view, I'm not criticizing it. Yet he and I both found ways, and we learned from people who were doing this too, to accept that structure, but also incorporate the social relations and valuing the workers and building trust and integrity. So I agree with you, Pedro, that it may be an excuse to say, it's just the bureaucracy, right? Well, you know, you're still an autonomous human being. You do have some ability to operate differently. I mean, I know it doesn't apply to everybody, but I always felt like I wasn't going to let the bureaucracy drive me to do things I thought were unethical or stupid.
Okay. Any other theme?
Yeah, another theme is, and I mentioned it during the podcast, but this is a good place to just remind the importance of it, the informal organization, you know, that's not logical in character, but it has a healthy function because it binds people into routine activity and gives them a social place and a sense of belonging. And I talked about how that was very similar to what Bernard, who published his work a few years, almost 10 years earlier, what he talked about. He said, you know, Bernard said it very strongly, you can't have informal and formal organizations separately. They must coexist. So I thought that was a very strong point.
In the little references he has Bernard, so he was probably very aware of his work.
I'm sure he was familiar with it. And then the last one that was on my list, I mean, we could come up with many others, but I think the last one I think was a kind of takeaway for our listeners is this clash on many levels with Taylorism, right? I mean, I don't think he's saying, you know, we should go back to the old ways, but it's had consequences for the way work is organized and the way people perform and feel about the work that they do.
Yes.
And that's very important to people like Mayo and Roethlisberger and us. Because Mayo and Roethlisberger and others exhort or encourage people to treat the workers like human beings, you know, like they matter and they are going to provide value as opposed to cogs in a machine. Kind of goes back to that negative view of the cybernetic view of the organization where it's all about control, right? And then you see Roethlisberger here kind of finishing up, and for him, control's in quotes because it's not exactly what has. I think that's a way of conveying it's not what that word normally means. It's a different way to control.
I love that point. And I think we discussed that, you know, in this episode. But I think the issue is, in a way, he picks up what Taylor lives in. That is, he's describing a situation that has the consequences of Taylorism. And he's not focusing on the worker, which makes it even more interesting. You know, it's not only, the workers are not autonomous anymore. It's like, well, even the people that are supposed to manage and make the people, you know, do the work, it's not very feasible in this way because they have no autonomy, they have no complete understanding, they are not allowed to have the connections and manage the connections, you know. So we need to reform this thing. So, and well, the whole scholarship after that has kind of, you know, picked up on that.
Well, that's a great observation, Pedro, that if you look at Mayo, right, and Banana Time and that stuff, he's focusing on the workers, which is important, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But it's interesting that Roethlisberger took this a different approach and said, it's not just that, it's also you're creating this, what Joe said earlier was this double bind for the manager. You know, you're putting him in, because we don't have, I don't think we have the luxury of saying, like, the workers' social relations don't matter, right? I mean, for Taylor, they were irrelevant. I think we know enough now to say, no, they do matter. Mm-hmm. And since they do, if you don't factor that into your form of organization and administrative processes, as Roethlisberger points out, you put your managers in this stressful and untenable position, which I think is what you were saying.
Yes. And, you know, also the whole relationships that, you know, because for Taylor, the relationship between the specialists, the foreman, the higher leaders, the workers, they're all like, you know, crystal clear. But of course, all the relationships are complicated, need to be you know, thought about, you know, how you're going to deal with the people suggesting the way the work should be organized, and how you're going to convey to the upper ranks what are the problems that are emerging. These are not automatic. So, you know, also yeah. that.
So I know that Joe was keeping his own list of themes, and I'm wondering, was there a good overlap, Joe? Do you have a couple things that you wanted to add?
So I think you've got my list pretty well covered. Fundamentally, we've got the same list. I don't really have too much to add. Although, I guess the one is for size of the challenge.
Right? Oh, okay. Good.
Right?
Okay.
Is you know, it appears, and it's a fairly significant challenge because of the title, that we're talking about the foreman, who in most organizations are somewhere between 10 and 15% of the organization. First level supervisors can vary. So it would seem like it's a relatively small slice. But when you apply the recursion and you realize that it's every level of the organization actually has this challenge.
Absolutely.
It becomes a much larger challenge, and one more, much more worthwhile to go after.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it, because I think if you don't see that recursion, you're missing a fundamental theme of this. It is not just the foreman, because it applies all up and down the organization.
I think it's almost like he takes the foreman as the entry into how this work system is. You know, you have to have someone to be the leading role, but then you can see the whole story.
Well, I think also it comes from the part that he was part of the 21,000 interviews that he and Elton Mayo conducted. And so probably he spoke to a lot of foremen in that experience.
Yeah, just reviewing the transcripts of 21,000 interviews makes my heart flutter. You know, maybe he didn't do that, but still, maybe he just took notes, but there you go.
On that note.
So any last words that I'm kind of come to this part of the podcast? I mean, I will say, I think it was a great article. Like a lot of these articles, I usually finish reading them thinking differently than when I started. And so I was thinking as I was taking notes, oh, I'm going to be very negative on this. And I'll be, because, you know, we've had episodes like that where we just kind of attack the author most of the way through. Mm-hmm. And so I think, and it was really helpful for me to see, you know, Joe kind of early in the first episode was talking about how you know, when you see that near the end, you realize, oh, he's taking me on a journey. And I'm not criticizing his writing style. It's just that I was having trouble seeing that come. And so I think also, and I hope our listeners experience it the same way, we tried to take you on a journey through the way we interpreted and understood the text. And then together, the three of us talked through our different understandings. And we still may have some, you know, slight different understandings, but I certainly have, and I hope our listeners do too, a different understanding now, even just based on my reading, by listening and talking with Joe and Pedro and finding what they think about it.
Yes, I agree.
And so for me, I found it interesting to see the extension of some of the ideas we covered in earlier topics. We've obviously talked about Taylor and some of the others, but also Wilmot in episode 30 and his discussion of the whole thing. And so that's, to me, it's very interesting to see how the body, as we expand, ties back to a wide variety of previous sessions.
I agree. And I think that's what is fascinating about, you know, reading the classics, is because you see the emergence of things that are still here. You see why they're speaking to, why they emerge in a specific place, you know, and help us understand, you know, to see that the challenge we are trying to understand contemporary organizations, you know, have a history and have many efforts behind to get the tools and ideas that we have today, you know. So I think it's always refreshing to go back.
And that's all for part two of episode 33. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or via our website. Don't forget that we now have a newsletter that comes out the day after each episode and contains some bonus and unique content. You can subscribe to that using your email only on our website. Please join us next time as we discuss Trist and Bamforth's 1951 paper, Some Social and Psychological Consequences of the Long Wall Method of Coal Getting, here on talking about organizations.